My name is Katie Otto, and the interview you are about to hear is with Ann Reeves, recorded March 26, 2019. It's part of the Voices series. I decided to interview white women ages 65 and older with experience in the civil rights movement to find out what worked, what didn't, and to hear lessons they wanted to share to those of us interested in anti-racist organizing moving forward. It was important to me to capture their stories, and it was also important to me to provide examples for other women like myself who want to think about and grapple with what it means to try to live an anti-racist life. Thanks for listening.
Okay, great.
There we go. Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me.
Well, I think it's a great idea.
I guess my first question I wanted to ask was how you first got involved in the civil rights movement and what that work looked like for you.
Well, I have to start with why I wanted to do it. And it's a little bit of a long story, so I'll try to shorten it as much as I can. But I lived in Southport, Connecticut, a very lily white community, and, reasonably affluent, and small elementary school. And across the street was an old lady. She probably isn't that much older than I am now, but anyway, she was an old lady who was, I guess, handicapped. I didn't know her one bit. I ended up knowing her son, who ended up being a congressman, but that's a long story. That was long before this time. And so she had a African-American woman named Eunice, who was her caregiver. She lived there, and she did the cooking and the cleaning. And Eunice was bringing up her granddaughter. And I never asked, and I never knew what happened to the mother, but she was completely out of the picture. So that granddaughter was named Audrey, and she was my age, exactly, and lived across the street. So she ended up going to my elementary school. And she was right across the street, so she became like a BF. You know, she was really one of my best friends. And what is really, she was in our school from first grade through fourth, I think. And then Eunice bought a house in Bridgeport with all her savings from cleaning. It's just remarkable that she was able to do that. But the beauty of it was that I played over at her house, and actually Eunice moved to a gentleman's house on the next block or behind the block behind us. And I remember going over there for dinner and understanding implicitly, but without any judgment, that their place was the kitchen and the bedroom off the kitchen, and that the house was not theirs, and the house was not available for us to play in. And at six, I seemed to get this. And I wouldn't want to, because the kitchen smelled so delicious. It was just, you know, she would make these hamburger scrambles, and I just remember feeling warm and cozy and welcome. And one time Audrey and I opened the door into the dining room of this widower's house, and it was all dark and gray and depressing, and it's like the kitchen was bright and it smelled good, and it had Audrey and Eunice and me, and life was good. So that's the foundation. And the amazing thing is that my parents never, and I really credit my mother, I don't know if she shushed my father or what, but they, if anything, they encouraged the friendship. I never got the idea that this was strange. And this is a bizarre thing in Southport, Connecticut, really, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just absolutely not done or not known. And so I had absolutely no idea that there was such a thing as discrimination. And although the teacher in the third grade did give the class a lecture one time when Audrey wasn't there about being nice to Audrey, and I remember being surprised by that. So there must have been some blowback, but maybe from a, I don't know, but I never heard about that. And so the summer between third and fourth grade, we belonged to a little sailing club, because South Florida's on the water, and it was so informal, and now it's like a country club, but in those days it was the most informal thing ever, and, you know, you could just go, you just went, and nobody noticed if you were late or not. You just went, and everybody hung out and learned about boats and went sailing. So I said to my mother, I'm going to bring Audrey today to the sailing club, and I just remember the look on her face. Was she said, you can't bring Audrey. And she looked stricken. I mean, she was really sad. And I just said, why not? I brought Clarissa last week. You're allowed to bring people. Well, you can't bring Audrey. And I said, why? She said, because she's colored. And I was like, absolutely. I think I slammed my sneaker on the floor and threw it across the room. I just said, that's not fair. And it was just, it brings me to tears even now to remember that. I remember exactly where I was sitting in my bedroom. And so I really credit her with that experience. I credit Audrey and her friendship and Eunice and my mother, you know, because Eunice was very professional with my mother, you know, and kept her distance, very nice. I mean, my mother, she ended up being our cleaning woman for like 30 years, and my mother supported her till she died, you know, and paid Social Security for her when she cleaned the house because she thought that was only fair. And so my mother had a huge role in this, but was a very quiet person and didn't, I never knew any of this when I was young. So then, and then I was the youngest of three children, and my brother and sister were like six and a half and 8 years older. And so they were in college, and my brother was back blackballed from my father's fraternity at Yale for working with black youth at the YMCA, you know. And so they were like Democrats, and our family were Republicans. And I just was so... They continued the work that had begun with Audrey, and so that by the time I got to college, I was already progressive.
Yeah.
And, well, I was and I wasn't. I was a progressive in civil rights. I didn't know anything about politics at that time, and I wasn't relating it to politics.
Yeah.
So that when the movement came along, of course I would, you know, of course I would. It was just such an obvious thing that it wasn't even a decision. And I fell in after I was married with people I hadn't known, hadn't grown up with that had, you know, had moved to Fairfield. And, you know, we had a backyard camp for kids from Bridgeport. I was just involved in lots of little things like that. And then, I remember marching, you know, in Bridgeport with our black friends. We became very friendly with, a black couple, and he was the head of the Urban Coalition, and I don't know, that was the start.
Yeah. So what kind of experiences then, if any, did you have maybe in college or with some of the civil rights?
So it's interesting that I never considered myself an activist. I was very immature in some ways, and I never considered myself an activist.
Yeah.
Yet. But I know that, like, my brother and my future brother-in-law went on Crossroads Africa, and so did this woman that was in my dorm who was a senior when I was a freshman, went on Crossroads Africa. And I remember thinking, I want to do something like that. Well, actually, when I was in high school, I went to a private school, and there weren't that many people in my class. And I remember standing up and announcing I was going to be the first Episcopalian female minister, and then I was going to be a missionary in Africa.
Oh,
so,
wow.
And that was in, like, the seventh grade. And I also read Cry the Beloved Country, and that catalyzed me. But I wasn't still, nobody had made the connection yet with, a political action. It was just the way I felt about things. You know, and so, but I always wanted to go to Africa from sixth or seventh grade on. I really, that was a goal. And then in college, I really didn't, I was kind of silly in college. I didn't really get involved in any particular movements that I can remember. But it was a very unpolitical campus. So, but it was when I got married And right away what happened was this man, and this older man that I really didn't know, who was active in politics, wanted me to run for the RTM, which is a town meeting. And I'm like 23 and having babies, or 24 maybe. And I'm like, okay. Like, all right. But then he wanted me to run on the Democratic ticket, and I had not yet declared whether I was a Democrat or Republican, because I sort of thought that was very naughty to be a Democrat, having grown up in a Republican family, and I'd never connected politics with my feelings about African Americans. I just hadn't done that yet. So, of course, the minute I became a Democrat and ran and all of this, I met people that were politically connected and much more sophisticated than I was, and became immediately involved in local actions, you know, like just summer camps for Black kids. And I got involved in a committee that did try to get middle-class income housing into our town, things like that. So I fell into a group of people that really pulled me along in that direction. Oh, just to go back, I did actually want to go to the March on Washington in 1963, but I happened to be, and I think I would have gone to that. So I was. I've never thought about this before. I should have thought about it before you called, but.
Okay.
but in 1963, the March for Freedom and Jobs, I was in Japan I had lived with a family for the summer and then had gone to China for a week because my brother had been teaching there. And so I missed the March on Washington, but I remember being really upset about missing it and wanting to go. So I guess I was more aware than I thought. And then have you ever heard of the Junior League?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people were in that, and I remember saying, I'm not going to join that. I'm not interested in drinking tea with ladies, you know. So I guess I really did have this other thing. I didn't have anywhere to put it because although my family was very warm and lovely about Eunice and Audrey, they weren't conservative by any means, but they were middle of the road, kind, nice people, and didn't make a fuss, you know, about anything. So I kind of was trying to find my own way. So, you know, after we got involved, you know, we started, I said I would never join the Junior League. And my father said, well, that's very unfair to your husband. And that, you know, you owe it to him. Yeah, I know. This is the thing. And my father was not this kind of, I mean, you would never look at him as anything but a very generous man. It was interesting, you know, but it just was very, and I said, well, I'm not going to do it. And then I found out that through this woman at church that they were beginning to actually do stuff in the inner city in Bridgeport. And it's like, really? And so that's when I did join. Because this older friend, she may be 8 years older than I was, maybe even 10 years older, but it really became my best friend for many, many years, Bonnie. And we were chosen to go to a 5-day symposium with a Black leader, the two of us, white women, to go to it was kind of an inner city planning, the whole point was to come out of this with a plan for some sort of interracial organization or program or something like that. So this was the guy that ended up heading up the Urban League, but, you know, so we planned a basketball program. I can't remember, but it was like really maybe 4 days of intense being with urban and suburban people, white and Black, and it catalyzed me. I mean, it was just the greatest thing. So I was, by that time, I was volunteering at a tutoring at a Black church in Bridgeport. I mean, this is all in the 66, 67, 68, 60, maybe early, maybe 70. Doing a lot of things and beginning to get blowback from people whose husbands told them that they didn't allow them to shop in Bridgeport, and here I was going in there all the time to black, white things. And I just, my father was a lawyer in Bridgeport, and he had raised us to support the city. He said, this is a city that supports us. This is where we get all our services. And so he would, you know, tell my mother she had to shop in Bridgeport at the department stores, and we would eat at restaurants in Bridgeport. And that, that again, was an unusual behavior for a suburbanite. So, but, you know, when your parents are doing it, you just think, oh, that's the way it is. And so I felt very comfortable being in Bridgeport. You know, I worked there the summer before I got married. I was very comfortable. So moving into the black community. So then with the Junior League, we got an opportunity for our 50th anniversary to do something really quite radical. And there was by that time a few radicals in there. And so we actually got three teenage white children from Andrew Ward High School, and two black young men from a project in Bridgeport, and had them get together and had them do a film together, the four kids. And they interviewed people, and they got to know each other. And then we had this huge showing in Bridgeport with the film. And then I was chairman of Black History Week for the Junior League. So I was in charge of getting speakers for 14 elementary schools and, you know, designing educational programs for those 14 schools. I guess I did a lot. I did more than all this is coming back now. So, so, you know, there were many times when we were the only whites at a gathering.
Yeah.
You know, and it was at a time that our church also made an alliance with St. Mark's Church in Bridgeport, both Episcopal. But the issue then was we were more radical than the people that went to church. They were always on their best behavior and very dressed up. And I think it was still Jim Crow, and they were afraid to. You know, they wanted to be, I mean, I wouldn't want to print this. I wouldn't want you to print. You know, it just seemed, because I think this could sound racist, you know, but it seemed like they wanted to look their best and fit in their best and weren't, you know, we sort of hung out with the more radical people, and then we also hung out with a bunch of very middle-class, upper-middle-class people. And they didn't seem to ever want to talk about race, or they just wanted to be nice to everybody and get along.
Gotcha.
And that was the first time I really began to understand in a deeper way that, like every society, you can't just say this is what black people want, this is what and how they are, you know. So we hung out with Percival Board, who was a dance married to Pearl Primus, and they were on Broadway. You know, we had him, you know, do a show here, and then he stayed at our house, and then we went to hear black poetry like at 2 a.m, and we were the only white people there. And, you know, Black Thighs, Agonize, and it was all about learning about South St. Louis. And, you know, so I just learned a whole lot then. And then, to be honest, I was very active in that movement and in the civil rights and in anti-Vietnam War movement through even when I had small children. But when I got divorced, I had to find a profession, you know, and I didn't have money. And I had to, you know, I went and got my doctorate in psychology, and that took like 6 or 7 years. So I really took a long hiatus from the movement until about maybe 10 or 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And when Jim Crow was coming out, and how I got, one way I got reinvolved is I was doing family history on my family in Virginia, and all of a sudden realized that they enslaved people. So I really did tons of research on that, and I went down to Virginia and did lots and lots of research trips to Duke University, which has a really great library. and also Richmond, Virginia. My brother and sister live in Richmond, so I always had a place to stay. And, you know, and I found, you know, the only letter that exists that my great-grandmother wrote, who was a Civil War widow. But, you know, my great-great-grandfather's great-great-great-grandfather died in the Civil War in the first battle, and his widow, who my mother knew, never changed her stance. She was like, thought it was a lost cause until she died in 1916. And she was all involved with, she and her husband were best friends with Jeb Stuart and his wife. So there are tons of letters between them. And he gave her boots or something. I don't know. And so I became very, very interested in finding out if I could find out who some of the enslaved people were. I mean, that I was going to write a book about this. I never did. But I really spent probably six solid years of traveling down south, maybe five times, you know, and really researching. And I went to the church that they were in. I went into their home and took photographs, saw where the enslaved people lived. I mean, they didn't have farm hands. This was my great-great-great-grandfather was a suburban doctor in West Virginia. And but I went to their church and spoke to their rector, and I had brought gloves with me, white gloves, and he allowed me, he said, well, I never let anyone do this, but this seems like it's important. So he let me spend like 4 hours with all of the really fragile papers from, you know, the Bibles and the all that, you know. And so I found out, for instance, that my relatives had gone to the trouble to have these children that were enslaved babies baptized. And he said that was a little bit uncommon, you know, that a white person would go to that trouble. So anyway, on and on.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask was what was some of the most difficult aspects to being involved in these projects and this work?
Well, I really can't say that I felt the only difficulties came from the blowback from white people, which didn't really bother me. I wanted very, very badly, very, very badly to go to Selma. I mean, I wanted to go down to that summer. I wanted to go down to in 64. In the summer of 65, I wanted to go down there for the Freedom Riders and all of that. And I actually got myself on a bus leaving Sacred Heart University, but it cost $100. And I didn't have $100. And I was married to a white banker who really learned a lot from me, and it affected how this is Betsy's father, you know, he became president of the bank eventually, and he wrote an autobiography that said that, that I had really, really affected the way he ran the bank in terms of lending.
That's interesting.
Families and also who was on the board, and, he ended up quitting. He quit a businessman's club that everybody were members of because they wouldn't let in blacks. And so he did in his quiet way a lot of things. And he says
that's,
I brought
that's
that.
Wonderful.
But he was not interested in marching or going out. You know, he had absolutely nothing to do with that part of my life whatsoever.
Gotcha.
You know, so I was caught between this suburban junior league, like country club existence on the one hand, and then this really radical, more radical black, you know, interest in black culture and friends and people like that. So it was I had my feet in two places. So at any rate, I did not go to Selma because I called my father to borrow $100, and he actually blasted me off the phone. One thing I should say is that I was pregnant. And then, you know, I was naively unaware of how dangerous that trip was. That was when Viola Liotto died, when I was killed.
Yeah.
Just for driving, you know, for driving volunteers, and left her body on the side of the road in her car. So, I mean, it was probably very good that I didn't go. I was pregnant with Betsy, I believe. And so I was not as involved or committed as the kinds of people that went. I did not dedicate my life to this. I did not get divorced and say, this is my life. I have to do this. So, you know, that's in some ways a personal disappointment in myself. But then I was just doing the best I could with the life circumstances that I was in.
Yeah.
At the time. But I think it's just now that people are really beginning to have conversations. So it was one thing to be for the cause and you're all together for the cause. But I think now what's happening is the whole idea of reconciliation. And people are starting finally to have conversations and to really listen to what it means to be Black in America. And the million times a day subtle insults or false beliefs that and assumptions that white people make about Black people. So I've had to really take a look at myself and my own attitudes. I wanted to say the link was after I did all this work in Virginia and starting to really wonder, could I ever hook up with a descendant of somebody whom my family enslaved, because that was my deepest desire. I heard on the radio this guy named Tom DeWolf being interviewed, and he was, like, in the next 2 or 3 days going to be in New York at the Unitarian Church promoting his new book. And I went to it. I was just dumbfounded, and it's an organization called Coming to the Table, CTTT, you could Google it, and it arose out of Eastern Mennonite University in Virginia, which has a record of peace studies and reconciliation studies. And basically, it was started for people who had ancestors on either side, whether they were Black or white, to explore that. And there have been, they've been in existence for maybe 10 years now, and it's gotten really, when I joined, it was maybe 300 people, and now it's thousands and thousands of people. But they have a conference every other year that's amazing, and they bring in speakers, and there's a lot of emphasis on knowing your own ancestry and doing the research. So one of the women that's active in that, for instance, Karen Brannon, just wrote a book called The Family Tree, and she comes from Georgia, and it was a journalist in Washington, D.C., very progressive politically, and there were all these stories that she never really quite heard from her background. And her grandmother, when she was dying, when Karen was interviewing her, the thing she remembered most was that noose. But then she wouldn't say any more. So Karen did research for 10 years, just what came up with this book last year, where her great-great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather was the town chief of police or constable or whatever you call it in Georgia. And he basically allowed a lynching to take place, didn't stop it, knew it was happening, and three people were lynched. One of them was a white boy. I don't know. At any rate, she had a blood relationship to both one of the victims and one of the perpetrators. And this was just staggering for her. And so she's written a book about it, and she goes around and speaks about this book. So, you know, a lot of really frank discussions come up. So this movement, CTT movement, has really helped me understand about my assumptions. I mean, I used to like driving Miss Daisy, and I had to really think twice about the Green Book, because I realized it's just, you know, using a Black person for a prop to make a white person look good.
Yeah.
And that way of thinking Plus, one of my best friends is a social worker in New York City, and she's head of all of the social workers in New York. She's the president of the New York Social Work Society or whatever. But she maybe 20 years ago started a nonprofit called Anti-Racist Alliance. And she's been involved in these deep, deep conversations over a weekend that you can go on where you really get into the nitty-gritty and really understand how deep the tentacles of racial institutional racism is, you know, and how white liberals are really hated by a lot of black people. So I've learned a lot in the last, say, 4 or 5 years about, you know, I mean, I loved what I did before, but honestly, there's a much more sophisticated, deeper knowledge, and I'm still learning, and I'm open to learning because I really don't feel I have it all figured out. I know I still have assumptions that are racist. So we have to listen, and I'm really interested in this whole discussion on reparations. I'm really, really interested in that, in what that means, you know.
I had a few other questions too that, but I think you're kind of touching on them. I did want to know what some of the most rewarding aspects to the work were.
Just the relationships. I mean, just meeting friends. We're very friendly with Kim and Reggie Harris, who are black folk singers who do school groups on the Underground Railroad, for instance. And, you know, they've stayed at our house many times, and we were up till 3 a.m. one time. And they said when they went to bed that is the deepest discussion they'd ever had, you know, with a white couple. And, it was just, you know, we could say things without feeling like we were offending someone, or if we were offending someone, we were just told that, well, that's not cool, you know, really look at it this way. So all the politeness that I've had, you know, in the past is turning into much more of a willingness to really listen, even if it involves being hurt or being embarrassed. So that those kinds of conversations have been really been a wonderful, just the camaraderie of people that feel the same thing you do. I mean, it was intoxicating in the 60s just because you really were on the side for something important, and you would put your life at risk for this because it's so important. And why don't other people understand? And I think there's an intoxication in not doing that by yourself, but really doing it with people that just have all this energy that keeps going because we have to.
I think that makes sense to me. That's a lot of why I wanted to try to take time to talk to people and get these stories together, so that I just think that there's a lot that people have to learn from movements and organizing that happened before I was born. And one of the questions I had was, what was the biggest lesson you had to learn in that time?
The biggest lesson I've learned is that how little I knew and understood, regardless of the fact that I thought I was doing good and that I was really charged up about it. I still remain humbled by how much I don't know, and still hearing stories about the Jim Crow era, which is still going on, you know, in many ways. I guess I've been, you know, I really, there's so much that I didn't know as a quote unquote white liberal, you know, and I'm now really willing to listen more than do and ask what can I do, as opposed to, I'd love to do this. And I'm just happy. I mean, I've been devastated by all these police shootings. I just cannot understand it. And I'm very involved, you know, emotionally in the whole gun safety issue, not only because of urban violence and these, you know, people that have just been shot down by police when they just twitch their hand a tiny bit. Because I live in the town next to Sandy Hook. So yeah. I did some counseling there, you know, and know a lot of people that are very involved with that. It's the next town over from me. And so it's all one piece, you know, it's all that violence is just gun violence. You know, accessibility of guns and all of that is something I'm really, really, I really want to do. But I just found myself fascinated, and I found myself loving Black culture. Not that there is a Black culture, but the various cultures that I've come in touch with. I did go to Africa, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, in 19, I went four times in the aughts. I went there because I had been very active in AIDS here for many years, and a friend of mine was invited to be the keynote speaker over 4 days at a conference for AIDS widows, and she asked if she was trying to get a group together to go, so I immediately said yes. And so basically it was in Kenya, and we were in, you know, out near Lake Victoria, really rather rural area, although Kisumu is the third largest city in the country, so it was there, but that was just intoxicating. I felt like this is where I belong, this is where I came from, which is actually true. Genetically, we all came from there. But you feel it, you know, and I said to the person running the conference, they were just opening an orphanage. And we got to see it, and we saw some of the kids that were going to move in. They were in a house next door, and so I said, in 2 years when the conference, they have this conference every 2 years, I'm going to come back a week early and do a project with the kids. And I had no idea. It just came out of my mouth that I would do that. So I made that promise. So since I'm a photographer also, I decided to have do something with photography. And I followed a model that Betsy told me about, actually, because Betsy tells me about everything. And used that model where each child had a camera, and I brought a friend with me who had been in the Peace Corps in the same area and knew tons of people. So, you know, it was really facilitated being part of the community and not being so foreign, because my friend Sharon just knew everybody. It was the same area that she'd been in like 3 years ago. And we saw like the chairman of her board, and he's Indian, and took us out to his restaurant every time we went. And so that was also, I just fell in love with Africa and Africans and Kenyans in particular. So when I came back, that's when I started doing all the research about how is my family implicated and what do I want to do about that. So that's where I still am, is, you know, what do I want to do about that? I don't know. But I'm just, anytime there's anything on the history of civil rights movement, I'm just all, you know, Bill tells me, you know, I think you're going to want to watch this show. And he's right, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of ask as a final question for the interview, what advice you would give young people today, and young white women in particular, who want to engage in civil rights and anti-racist organizing?
I would say to do the hard work of really understanding the extent to which this country has been racist for so long, and that even with 400 years, and to be aware, to read books like The New Jim Crow and so many other new books that are out all the time, that it's always been driven by white liberals. You know, they were the ones organizing. Not when maybe they got down to Selma, they worked with local people. But I mean, then again, the heroes became the white people that you heard about, and not the people in those communities. I went on a really, there is a really, really great, this is something I would suggest, actually. The Unitarian Church every year has a group that takes people on a four or five day civil rights tour. And you go to all the museums. And when I went in Mississippi and in Alabama, we met. We were at the church where Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed, or that town. And it was just mind-blowing to see how many heroes, to hear of the courage of small-town people who will never be in the newspaper, or maybe in their local newspaper they will be, but you know, you and I would never know their names. And they have been working and working for civil rights since they were five or eight or whatever. And that, you know, so often people think about the civil rights movement being Martin Luther King, John, you know, in the Congress. I want to say John Adams, you know, the congressman who was on this bridge at Selma.
John Lewis?
John Lewis, yeah, right,
yeah.
Right. You know, and it's just really important to read the history. It's really important to know the history. It's really important to talk to local people and find out what's going on and to kind of get the underneath the superficial, to not be afraid to talk about reparations. I mean, people are like so polarized because they think reparations means I want a handout from you. That's, you know, I want, you know, and there should be, because the government has screwed generations and generations of half the country. But it, to me, it's more about like Rwanda and South Africa. It's the spirit of reconciliation and an understanding that harm was done, and a really deep commitment of apology. And a lot of churches have done this. Like a lot of New England churches were very implicated in the slave trade. And I would say for anyone who lives in New England to not think this was a Southern thing, any young white people in New England needs to understand that the wealth of Connecticut and the wealth of Massachusetts come and Rhode Island come directly from the triangle trade. And unfortunately, in another whole side of the family, my family was totally implicated in that trade as well. One of them ran one of the ships, and we have the log books of that. So, you know, understanding the dynamics of the triangle trade and how exactly it worked and who benefited. And basically, it was people in New London and Bristol, Connecticut, Bristol, Rhode Island, and you know, it's a whole story. There's a whole group of really great books on slavery in New England and the trade, triangle trade in New England, and the log books that are really worth reading and becoming educated. Also, I would say to young white women to really take stock of your white privilege. It's not that you have to leave what you're doing and go work and be in the inner city or be in the middle of this if you don't want to, but that to own it, to own that. If I didn't know Mrs. McGillicuddy, who's, I didn't go to Smith, but I'm just using that as an example, you know, that's how I got into this school, you know, because I knew people that had gone, I knew the language. I didn't go to that school. I'm not smart enough to go to Smith, but, you know what I'm saying, that I don't think people really understand how the words they daily say make assumptions that sort of are implicated in a kind of polite racism, because it's coming from ignorance. You know, like, look how well everybody's doing. There are people in politics, you know, people have access to professions. They don't understand that the wealth that goes down from generation to generation to generation in many, many white families was never been available because they couldn't get a mortgage. So even if they had the money, and wanted to buy a house. They could not buy that house. So four generations down, you're not going to have, you know, building on the generation before you that became stable and maybe economically successful. That's just not possible for so many families. And it's not about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, they don't have boots. So I think there's still a tremendous amount of naivete and ignorance about really how unfair this has been for so many centuries and how it really continued up until the 50s, through the 50s. You know, even the lynchings continued into the 50s. You know, that's my lifetime. I mean, that's just disgusting.
Yeah.
So also we need to rewrite the history books. History books give absolutely no that the children read. You know, just are so simplistic and they don't. Everyone is a caricature. Native Americans are a caricature. And it brings us into the Native American and what we did to them, too. I mean, that's just, they're part of this. And they feel ripped off because everyone got interested in black people. Instead, it was much, much more interesting or something. I don't know. So that's what I would say.
This is really helpful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you speaking to me. And I will, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these interviews, and I'm making a digital archive for folks to check out. So I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me. Thank you so much.
Well, that's great. Are you an academic or?
Nope. I'm just a person who was inspired to do this project. I actually play music for fun, and I work at a nonprofit for my day job, but I wanted to do this project because I have found a lot of value in having these conversations with my own mother. So,
how fabulous
is that? So it's just a labor of love.
So how did you know Betsy?
Through music.
In Providence, or?
Well, I don't know where we crossed paths exactly. I believe that we met through music, but I don't know exactly where. I have a couple of friends in Providence through music, and I think that is how she and I first connected.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. I really appreciate it. And I'll be in touch when I get these all posted.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.